I think the real opportunity for accountancy is to think about bigger picture, the idea of bringing certainty to an uncertain world, helping people find new paths to prosperity.
Hey gang, welcome back. This is Future Proof. Let's see, we're working on episode 88 this week. And I've been your host for all of them. I'm Bill Sheridan. We've got a good one for you this week, which I guess would imply that some of these shows have been bad ones. And that is simply not true, folks. There's not a bad one in the bunch. But this one, I think, is especially good because we've got Jeffrey Rogers with us this week. Jeff is principal facilitator at Singularity University, which is a global learning and innovation community that uses exponential technologies to tackle the world's biggest challenges. And if that all sounds familiar, well, there's a good reason for that. We've had folks from Singularity U on the show before, most notably, Pascal Finette, who is the co-founder at Be Radical, which teaches leaders how to create new business models for success and how to positively embrace disruption, how to prepare people to be future forward and future ready. Pascal is also chair for entrepreneurship and open innovation at Singularity University. So we're going back to the Singularity University well this week with Jeff Rogers. We spend a lot of time here talking about exponential technologies and the disruptive impact they're having on our world. And Jeff kind of turns the tables on that mindset and focuses instead on the importance of exponential thinking. And we'll talk about what all of that means here in just a few minutes. First, let me tell you that this week's show is brought to you by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Next, here's what caught my eye this week. So this conversation is all about thinking exponentially and embracing disruption. And the world recently lost one of its pioneering thought leaders in this field of disruption, disruptive innovation, and future readiness. And of course, I'm talking about Clayton Christensen, a Harvard Business School professor, founder of the Christensen Institute. That's a Boston-based think tank, maybe best known for his groundbreaking 1997 book, The Innovator's Dilemma, which CNN says is credited with pioneering the concept of disruption that much of Silicon Valley now treats as a mantra. Clayton Christensen died on January 23rd from complications from cancer treatment. He was just 67 years old. Here's an idea of how influential that book, The Innovator's Dilemma, was. It was said to be the only business book that Steve Jobs kept on his bookshelf. That is influence right there. But Clayton Christensen, I mean, we could spend all day reflecting on his ideas and insights into disruption, but instead I wanted to spend some time looking back at an article he wrote in 2010 titled, How Will You Measure Your Life? And this one really hit home for me. I'm just going to let him read it for you. Here's what he writes. He says, quote, over the years, I've watched the fates of my Harvard Business School classmates from 1979 unfold. And I've seen more and more of them come to reunions unhappy, divorced, alienated from their children. I can guarantee you that not a single one of them graduated with the deliberate strategy of getting divorced and raising children who had become estranged from them. And yet a shocking number of them implemented that strategy. And the reason? They didn't keep the purpose of their lives front and center as they decided how to spend their time, talents, and energy. It's quite startling that a significant fraction of the 900 students that Harvard Business School draws each year from the world's best have given little thought to the purpose of their lives. I tell the students that HBS might be one of their last chances to reflect deeply on that question. If they think that they'll have more time and energy to reflect later, they're nuts, because life only gets more demanding. You take on a mortgage. You're working 70 hours a week. You have a spouse and children. For me, having a clear purpose in my life has been essential. The choice and successful pursuit of a profession is but one tool for achieving your purpose. But without a purpose, life can become hollow. And then he says, he goes on to say this. He writes, your decisions about allocating your personal time, energy, and talent ultimately shape your life's strategy. If you misinvest your resources, the outcome can be bad. As I think about my former classmates who inadvertently invested for lives of hollow unhappiness, I can't help believing that their troubles relate right back to a short-term perspective. If you study the root causes of business disasters over and over, you'll find this predisposition toward endeavors that offer immediate gratification. If you look at personal lives through that lens, you'll see the same stunning and sobering pattern. People allocating fewer and fewer resources to the things they would have once said mattered most. And then finally, Christensen closes with this. He writes, this past year, I was diagnosed with cancer and faced the possibility that my life would end sooner than I'd planned. The experience has given me important insight into my life. I have a pretty clear idea of how my ideas have generated enormous revenue for companies that have used my research. I know I've had a substantial impact, but as I've confronted this disease, it's been interesting to see how unimportant that impact is to me now. I've concluded that the metric by which God will assess my life isn't dollars, but the individual people whose lives I've touched. I think that's the way it will work for all of us. Don't worry about the level of individual prominence you've achieved. Worry about the individuals you have helped become better people. This is my final recommendation. Think about the metric by which your life will be judged and make a resolution to live every day so that in the end, your life will be judged a success. End quote. And, you know, for all the influence Clayton Christensen has had on the world of business, that might be the best thing he's ever written. Just some terrific food for thought there. So rest in peace, Clayton Christensen. And still yet time marches on, right? And the question remains, how do we start to deal with all the disruption we're feeling today? And my guest this week, Jeff Rogers, says a great place to start is by practicing a little exponential thinking. He talked a bit about that during a keynote address at the 2019 fall meeting of the AICPA's governing council. And he says remaining relevant in a changing and complex world comes down to two things. Number one, being open and willing to change. He says, we still, if anything, tend to underestimate the scope of the change and also the pace. At the same time, he says, there's a lot of opportunity there. And number two, embracing lifelong learning. And we've said this time and time again, but Jeff Rogers says, my big interest is helping people see their opportunity to embrace continuous learning, to be in position to capitalize on the opportunities that a shifting landscape will reveal. So he's got some great thoughts for us this week about where our profession is going, what it's going to look like when it gets there, and some thought-provoking questions that CPAs ought to be asking themselves about their place in the future of this profession. So some really great insights here from as deep a thinker as you'll find about this stuff. Here is my conversation with Jeffrey Rogers. So Jeffrey, thanks for being here. I guess my first question for you is, and I base this question based on the fact that you're the second person from Singularity University that I've interviewed for this podcast. I spoke with Pascal Finette not too long ago as well. But so I'm curious what Singularity University is. What do you guys do there?
Well, first, let me say thanks for having me, Bill. It's my pleasure to join. And it sounds like I'm in good company if you've had Pascal on already. Hopefully, my answer will track reasonably well with his. Singularity is kind of an interesting organization. I would say that the real thrust of our work is around educating and empowering leaders to utilize emerging technology to solve grand challenges, to do things that matter out in the world.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough. And I think we've got a number of those types of challenges facing us here in the accounting and finance profession. And there have been all kinds of predictions recently about the impact that new technologies like AI, machine learning are going to have on our profession, ranging anywhere from, you know, like near complete automation for all the doomsayers out there to more of a partnership between humans and machines. I'm kind of curious, what do you think? What does the future of this profession look like to you?
Sure. And that actually builds pretty nicely on the first question. And candidly, I gave you kind of a boilerplate answer about what SU is and does. That might even be in the mission statement. Something very close to that I can say is our purpose. But if we dig a little bit deeper into what really matters to me and what I think some of our most important work is, I think it lies in the idea of preparing humanity for accelerating change. Mm-hmm. Right, learning to live, to thrive, and to lead in an era of accelerating change. And what does that mean? What does it look like? Well, one thing is exploring possible futures. And possible futures means actually sitting down with and creating space for these points where we really don't know exactly how things are going to play out. We can deal with probabilities and we can deal with likelihoods, but you know, when you're looking at that full range of the hard dystopian to the extreme utopian, the reality is almost always somewhere in the middle, something centopian. And I think there's a real moment for us at the species level, but also absolutely as professionals in any industry, accounting certainly being one of them, to think about how we can move now to act with intention, to build some resilience against some of the downside possibilities that we hope to ward off or to not be completely blindsided by, while at the same time working with intention to be more likely to realize the preferred futures, the ones that we do want to see. And, you know, looking at this specific industry, I think there's incontrovertible evidence that we are moving toward an era of increased capability to automate and to augment computational thinking. And when you're looking at any sort of rote task, when you're looking at things that are simply computational or compliance-based, a lot of that kind of work, I think, is going to become easier and easier to hand off to systems that are increasingly automated. And then for me, the question becomes not what do we do about that, but what does that allow us to do? Hmm. I think that's the direction we're heading in, and I don't think it's wise to try to stand in the way of that. I think that, you know, there is a market logic that is going to drive us toward that outcome, and I think what we should be focused on is this question of, as you said, how do we work with these new technologies? What do they free us up to do better? What are the things that remain still uniquely within the province of the human operator, the trusted expert, the advisor? The same idea of navigating all this uncertainty in your industry, if you're in accounting, that applies to everyone else as well. So there's going to be a radically shifting economic landscape. And I think the real opportunity for accountancy is to think about bigger picture, the idea of bringing certainty to an uncertain world, helping people find new paths to prosperity.
I think that's really interesting. And I love your notion of not necessarily focusing on what these technologies do, but what they would allow us to do. What are some of those things that you think they might allow us to do or spend more time doing or, you know, working on to add greater value to those that we work with?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I will be candid. This is not my field, but mm-hmm. I think we can see analogs across, you know, any number of professions, disciplines, and industries. And in fact, earlier in my career, I was working in an organization doing instructor coaching and faculty development for a firm that had a very large, broadly distributed pool of instructors. And I had to help build online systems for supporting all of these teachers in our network. I'm an educator by trade. And frankly, a lot of what I was doing over and over again. And I was looking for ways to scale this stuff. And I also was looking for ways to minimize the amount of my time that I had to spend answering the same question, providing the same kind of report, the same kind of support across a pool of 2,000 instructors with a pretty high turnover year to year. And I actually spent a fair amount of time in my last year with the company basically trying to automate myself out of that job. And I couldn't do the whole thing, and I'm certainly not that level of coder, but I was able to stitch together with a little bit of JavaScript, some Google Apps script, and some different tools that we had available for remote work there, I was able to stitch together a bunch of systems that required less and less repetitive work from me and allowed me to have more time to really focus on the human elements and to really focus on the things that required more contextual reasoning and more navigating of complexity and ambiguity, things that even if I had the coding wherewithal and the chops, I wouldn't have been able to automate. And so I think we should, generally speaking, be looking for ways to do what we can do best with the emerging technologies while freeing up ourselves to focus on the things that the human operator can still do best within what, at the end of the day, are human systems. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the thing. The technologies, whatever we choose to design and deploy, they're only successful if they align with and support the values and the valued outcomes within a human system.
Yep. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And you know, stepping back here for a second, as we're talking about how quickly these technologies are advancing, and then I think that's really why we're having these conversations right now, is people in our profession anyway are a
little, this is the time to have them,
a little freaked out with the speed with which this stuff is going. And I mean, we've all heard of Moore's Law by now and are seeing its impact kind of firsthand. But when you were talking with the folks at the AICPA's governing council, you mentioned a couple of other interesting concepts that I think people are less familiar with. I was wondering if you could kind of expand a little bit on specifically Amara's Law and
sure.
Kurzweil's Law. I thought those were really interesting concepts, and I don't think a lot of people are familiar with them.
Yeah, much less so, which is part of why I always try to highlight these things. And I'm very interested when I connect with a group and have any kind of conversation around future thinking. Wherever I can, I like to de-emphasize the focus on a single kind of whiz-bang, wow, high wow factor result achieved in an R&D setting or a lab that gives us a proof of concept that may be a long ways off mm-hmm. and may not really give us an idea of how this thing is going to scale in industry or in the market, and instead try to highlight some of the underlying principles and dynamics that can give us a better chance, not necessarily of predicting the future, but at least of being less surprised when it arrives. Mm-hmm. So the two that you mentioned, I think these are both great. And like Moore's Law, I would say Amara's Law, it's not like a law of physics. This is a really keen observation of human behavior, and it seems to be a very durable heuristic. And it takes its name from Roy Amara, who was president of the Institute for the Future, which is another Silicon Valley organization that has a lot of overlap with Singularity. And Amara famously noted that we tend to overestimate the impact and effect of a new technology in the short term, and then underestimate the effect and impact of the same technology in the long term. And we do this over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I think you can probably pick some examples from your own experience, your own life. I can certainly see some in mine as well, where there's something that we feel like once we hear about it, the transformative impact must be just around the corner. And we're looking for that thing, and we're maybe investing in it. We're maybe betting on it. We're waiting for that massive disruption to be driven by the result that we're sure is likely in the near term.
Yep.
And then when that thing doesn't come, we wind up disappointed, disillusioned, dismissing the thing as wildly overhyped and nowhere near market viability or capability of being deployed at scale in a meaningful fashion. Mm-hmm. And that's when people routinely take their eye off the ball.
Yep.
And stop watching that field. Stop waiting for this thing to happen. Stop preparing for it to happen or incorporating it into design plans for building solutions for the future that they want to create. And instead start looking at other things. And then when the technology does mature, which often happens in dramatic fashion, which I can come back to in a minute, because a lot of these technologies are advancing exponentially, then we wind up being surprised by something that we should have been watching all along. And we end up with something that Peter Diamandis likes to call an overnight success that was 10 years in the making. And we're somehow caught off guard, even though we've known about it for quite some time. I mean, one of the ones that I think is great for this is thinking about augmented or virtual reality. That I feel like every year for the last 10-ish years, I've heard, well, this is going to be the year. This is going to be the year of VR. This is going to be the year that AR really breaks through. And every year, we wind up underwhelmed. But I think with AR in particular, we've probably turned that corner now, and we're starting to see those transformative applications. But I think a lot of people had kind of dismissed this stuff as overhyped in 2017, and they're not prepared for 2020.
I kind of fear that we're going down that type of road with blockchain, especially in our profession. I mean, people have been talking about the potential, the opportunities for years now, and we're starting to see people saying, "Yeah, well, where are the results? Nothing's happening about this," and they're starting to, I believe, as you said, take their eye off that ball, and may be chalking it up to something that didn't live up to the hype. And then I think we're going to be terrifically surprised in the not too distant future when it starts to take off.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent example. You know, I mentioned in the session with AICPA that I did that if people want to get a better feel for Amar's Law in practice, if you've seen the hype cycle reports that Gartner puts out every year, where they kind of chart where either emerging or even already deployed out in the field technologies are relative to kind of market expectations, you see this predictable curve where there's increasing enthusiasm, heightened expectations, then a fall into a trough of disillusionment, and then a steady climb out afterward. And I think you're absolutely right to see blockchain as somewhere along that journey right now. And we have to remember that that technology in particular is one where we really are still in the very early days. And a lot of us were kind of in on the ground floor watching the thing, even if we were not at all participating in that space. I mean, it was only 10 years ago that the Bitcoin white paper was published. And I think probably now maybe 4 years or 5 years since developers have been able to execute smart contracts on blockchain. And, you know, for me, that's a big part of it. When you have the potential of being able to write in and then execute the rules of a system such that these things can be close to fully autonomous. I mean, the idea of having a distributed autonomous organization, which is at its heart a blockchain project, that's something that we're still only kind of seeing be felt out right now. But once somebody demonstrates how to do it really well, I think it's going to be copied, replicated, and deployed with remarkable speed. And again, I think a lot of people are going to feel surprised.
Yep.
That's another piece, actually, Bill, if I can close with one thing on this before we move on, that I think is pretty critical to note. And if we talk about Kurzweil's Law, this is going to come up as well. But the idea right now that so many of the tools of the innovator and so many innovations are more and more, if not entirely digital, they can be shared and replicated much more quickly and easily across geographic boundaries than had ever been the case at any point in human history, right? If there is something about proximity and ease of flows of information and ideas that is conducive to innovation, and absolutely that is the case, those flows are less restricted than ever before because everything is being digitized and it's so easy to share information. And if the tools of the innovator increasingly are you know, down to data, bits, languages, and protocols, those things can cross over and jump from market to market very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, when you think about how quickly this stuff is moving and the exponential rate at which these things are changing, it's almost as if we have to start, you know, accepting that almost anything will be possible going forward when it comes to these technologies and how quickly they're moving. I mean, because exponential change is a tremendous and frightening thing in a lot of ways.
It is. And it's something that we, again, as a species, did not evolve to understand and process well, right? I mean, I know that this is kind of a cliche at this point, but it still is worth pointing out that the last time we had a meaningful upgrade or evolution of our kind of cognitive wetware was 50,000 years ago plus, right? And that was a very different world. And our ancestors' brains, which became our brains, evolved to thrive in a world where information processing largely came down to the local and linear. And conceptualizing exponential change is not an easy thing to do. Even if you know that it's important, it's still a hard thing to do. Our intuition leads us, generally speaking, to imagine the change that we will see going forward to be relatively aligned with the amount and commensurate with the amount of change that we've seen in the past.
And that's just not where it's headed, which kind of leads a little bit, I think, into Kurzweil's law. Can you tell me a little bit about what that...
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is something that is, I think, you know, foundational for not only the conversation that we're having, but the work that we've done at Singularity University, and I think really on a deep level, understanding possibilities and potential in a society where so many aspects are, if not determined, at least heavily driven by the emergence and spread of new technologies. So Kurzweil's key insight here is that technologies develop within evolutionary systems. So systems that learn by trial and error, right? Most of us, when we hear evolutionary, we think of biology, and this is really the same kind of idea. And in fact, technological evolution was kicked off by the process of biological evolution, where it took a really, really, really long time to get from, you know, microorganisms to something that was able to crawl about and then eventually stand up. But then as we move through each stage of evolution, the advances come more quickly. And eventually we hit on a species that is capable of using tools and creating new technologies. And once we're in that era of technological evolution, again, initially, the advances are few and far between. It takes a very, very long time in human history to hit writing, written language, or pottery, or the development of the first cities. It takes a very long time to get to mathematics, to get to physics. But what you see is at each stage of this evolutionary process, the best results, of course, the ones that are most adaptive, are carried forward. And those are used to create the next round of experiments, which will create the next round of results. And in every successive iteration, the advances come more quickly and the returns are more powerful and they accelerate over time. And what we wind up with, if we look at kind of the big picture of human history and technological advance, we see that as we've grown the size and scale of human civilization, we've seen the process of innovation, the rate of solution architecture itself, accelerate dramatically. And in fact, if we chart this, it actually makes a nice exponential curve, such that it looks like just within the last 100 or 150 years, everything starts to happen almost all at once as these successive advances feed upon each other. And through what technologists call combinatorial innovation, right? Using the last generation's building blocks to create the next generation's solutions, that process continues to accelerate. And, you know, again, going forward, this idea that we're now at a point where the tools of the innovator are digital, they're going to be easier to recombine, and they're going to be easier to transmit and share at scale through society should only accelerate that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The example that I've often heard with Kurzweil's law has to do with like the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. What does he say about that? It's like we won't be experiencing 100 years worth of advancement. It's going to be more like, and I forget the number that he used, but that was the essence of Kurzweil's law.
Yeah, I think it's something like 10,000. I don't have that quote in front of me, but yeah, that essentially is the idea. And you know, we can see this for anyone who doubts, we can see this broken down into, you know, more discrete fields where we started with Moore's law earlier in this conversation. If you look at computation, this definitely holds true. The price performance of computation has followed this pretty predictable exponential advance, not only through the era of Moore's law, but, and this is one of Kurzweil's famous arguments, if you actually start looking further back than that, you can see that the history of information processing technology back to the turn of the 20th century is all on that same curve. Mm-hmm. And Kurzweil identifies five paradigms of information processing technology, going from a system that was very dependent on humans to a system that is less and less so, right? Where now we're actually using computers to build the next generations of computers. And even as we see the potential for Moore's law as we've known it, the transistor era to eventually level off, right? And that is Moore's law, is this series of nested S-curves. Mm-hmm. We can already start to see the seeds of what will likely be a sixth paradigm, whether that's quantum computing, which we're starting to hear an awful lot about lately, or using nanotechnology to kind of transcend the physical limitations of the Moore's law paradigm.
The mind boggles truly when you start talking about it at that level. So what do CPAs, or maybe it's not even CPAs, maybe it's just humans in general. What do we need to do in order to remain relevant in an environment like this?
Oh, yeah, that is the big question, right? And I want to stress again that I don't think that this is what do CPAs need to do. I think this is what do people need to do. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you chose the word relevant there, because that's part of what this question hinges on, right? I think we need to think about this in a couple of different ways. One is maintaining our economic viability, right? As contributors to a profession, to a system, as earners in an economy, and producers in an economy. So that's one piece. And then the other piece of relevance, of course, is this idea of meaning. And there is, I think, in the long term, more important question when we're talking about the future of work and the future of different professions that gets to, what do we need to do to address the fact that so many people derive so much of their sense of meaning from their work and their professional affiliation? Mm-hmm. And I think these are actually related. I'm going to start with the first one, because I think in some ways it's a lot easier to get a handle on. So I think at a fundamental level, this is applicable to pretty much everyone, whatever they're doing and whatever they think the horizon or shelf life of their current skill set might be. That shelf life is probably shorter than you think. And so we need to be thinking not just about upskilling or reskilling, but meaningfully embracing lifelong learning. I think that we're moving away from a world in which you know, you get your certification or you get your post-grad degree, what we call a terminal degree, right? And you're done. Like, you know what you need to know. And now you're going to be successful, and you've hit kind of a steady state of knowledge and proficiency within a field that should carry on indefinitely. I'm not sure that was Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think that's exactly where our CPAs and accountants and finance professionals have been for mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, you earn that degree, you get that CPA designation, and you know, the time was that level of experience and education could carry on for decades, and it just doesn't anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't. And in some ways, I think we may have, for a while, had a little bit of cherished illusion and held on to the story of, you know, people being complete in their learning when, one, they're probably not. Two, they're probably missing further opportunities that would be available to them were they to embrace continuous learning. Mm-hmm. And three, at this point, I think we're definitely, you know, putting the lie to that scenario. And not just in accountancy, but I believe across any number of professions and disciplines, we're seeing with the advance of technology and the evolution of the industry, of the market, of new consumer needs and expectations, and also the development of new opportunities, there's a real imperative, and again here also an opportunity for the operator, for the professional, to seek out new learning, new knowledge, new skills, to be able to make the most of that evolving landscape. And one, to be able to navigate it successfully, to thrive within it, but two, to identify what are the new value propositions? What is the new business model? And what are the new skills? And it can be kind of terrifying, but I would argue that there's also a freedom within the idea that you're never a finished product anymore. Mm-hmm. In a world of accelerating change and a world that's always in the process of becoming something new, you're always going to be new to the world. And you have the opportunity to become something new as well. And right now, I think we have a moment also where we're looking at what's becoming a superabundance of available content and even trainings that can help us realize that new skill set and to help us continue that process of perpetually becoming something new. And I worked in e-learning early on when digital education was basically just like a web page with maybe, if you're lucky, a link to a video or two and a couple of articles.
Right.
But now we're actually at a point. I mean, I facilitated a session in a VR environment for a group of executives who were doing a reunion from their executive education program on Tuesday. And it was fantastic. I ran an activity that I've done probably dozens of times in physical space. I did it on a social VR platform for the first time. And this is a kinesthetic spatial activity. And I was amazed with how well the dynamics of that game mapped into this virtual environment. And I think the executives who attended were also amazed. And we all walked away with a sense of new possibility and a little bit of an exposure to a new tool. And I think these are the kinds of experiences that we need to continually seek out right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What? So, I mean, our marching orders going forward are to become, you know, kind of professional students, lifelong learners. What does that look like, to always presenting a new version of ourselves to somebody else? I mean, I think the phrase you used to counsel was adaptive practices. I'm interested, what are some of these types of practices that we should start implementing now?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for queuing that up. Clearly, you've done this kind of thing before. So I think some of the ones that I mentioned there probably, and this may be one of the most important, is the idea of asking new and different questions, right? If you feel like you already have the answers to all the questions that you might have within your field or your domain, then you need to look further out. Or you need to look a little bit more deeply and more critically and start bringing in some more contextual knowledge to help you rethink and reimagine your domain and reimagine your role and the value that you support within it. And I believe that part of the importance of engaging with some of these larger conversations about emerging technology and looking outside of your own immediate industry or profession to see, you know, how you might find your field disrupted, because that disruption usually comes from outside. I think that's going to help us all reimagine our roles and ask new questions about it. And if we're asking new questions, we're likely to come up with new answers and to see new opportunities. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two, which is related, is to really learn to see and think in systems. And we all do this on some level. I mean, this is how the world is stitched together and how we make our way within it. But really learning to think a little bit more ecologically and start to see the interrelationships and dependencies within the systems that we're embedded and the systems that we support. Again, to be able to better anticipate change and to pick up on change earlier while we have a little bit more time to prepare ourselves and to position ourselves such that we'll be able to realize a more favorable outcome. I think both of those are huge.
Well, give me an example of what you mean by systems. You see and think in terms of systems. So what does that look like? What does that mean?
I mean, I would say for accountancy, there is a kind of prescribed and well-understood role that the accounting discipline plays within larger systems of value, transaction, economy, et cetera. And seeing the system, rather than just focusing on one's immediate, near-term, established role within it, I think means looking further out and trying to understand how markets are changing and the needs of customers and partners are changing, rather than just focusing on likely changes to one's own role mm-hmm. and one's own profession. If all we're thinking about is what is the emergence of a new AI system going to do to how I, you know, run my business day to day or how I perform X, Y, and Z tasks, mm-hmm. that's like asking, is the spreadsheet going to make me obsolete? Mm-hmm. Probably not. And it shouldn't. And if that's all we're focused on, then we're missing a much grander canvas of potential opportunities. And, you know, here we're talking about a much larger set of changes than just bringing in spreadsheets or Excel. And I think that the leaders who are exhibiting the most future fitness going forward and are going to realize the greatest potential and the greatest outcomes here are going to be the ones who can see the opportunity to articulate new value propositions and then build themselves and their business to support those value propositions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that gets a little bit back to that idea of thinking about a larger purpose going forward. But I mean, there with regard to seeing and thinking in systems, I think this also comes to a meaningful point with the implementation and development of new technologies. You know, as I said earlier, all of these new tools are going to be deployed within human systems. And we should think about what is the best way to do that.
Right.
And just because we could create a technological solution for something, or just because we think that there is a solution to a complicated problem, doesn't necessarily mean that we're seeing the bigger picture of complexity and understanding it as a complex problem where a technical solution may not be sufficient because there are sticky, irreducibly human elements that mm-hmm. tend to make everything a little bit harder.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and if you're going to affect like change within an organization, you have to account for culture. Change within a profession, you have to think about the people and how they relate to their partners.
I mean, yeah, there's so many different levels to this conversation. It strikes me. I once heard a futurist by the name of Peter Sheehan speak.
Yes,
and he said something that has always stuck with me since that presentation. He said humans should only be doing work that only humans can do. And that kind of speaks a little bit to what you're talking about right there. I mean, there's a definite human element involved in the evolution of ourselves and our profession that machines at least so far are not able to touch.
Absolutely. And I think I recognize that this also is a very complex challenge, you know, feeling our way forward here where we don't know what all of the steps are going to be to take. But if we can have an idea of, you know, some principles or guiding lights or a North Star, you know, this idea that you're going to always focus on supporting, nurturing, investing in the uniquely human, that is a thing that you can kind of learn your way in the direction of. And I think it's really important. I remember maybe a year or two ago, I was on a program through Singularity University, and I was there as the moderator. And we had Vivian Meng, who is based in Berkeley and is a neuroscientist and AI researcher and entrepreneur, delivering a session on something within artificial intelligence. And I didn't have a lot of context on what it was going to be. I thought she was going to talk more technically about AI systems building. And she wound up spending 35 minutes talking about the critical importance of the skill of complex problem solving as like the only really important human thing going forward.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think everyone walked away basically with the same kind of sense that you had coming out of the session with, or the thing that you read from Peter. And yeah, now how we actually honor that is another question, but I think it's a really important thought to sit with.
Yeah. And so this, I'm interested in your thoughts on this as an educator at heart, and I guess I'm thinking for those of us who are charged with helping in our, you know, in my example, helping CPAs prepare for what's next. And here I'm thinking about people like educators and associations and regulators. What do we need to do to kind of help those that we serve become a little bit more future ready?
Yeah, that's absolutely a question that I spend a lot of time with as well. So I think one big one is the idea of, and this is another adaptive practice, I think, creating and articulating new narratives, right? I think mm-hmm. it's critically important that we actually are able to paint a picture of a positive and inclusive future that people can see themselves in. Mm-hmm. Right, we tend so often to have this superabundance within the culture of really dim views of the future. Right, a lot of dystopian narratives, and you know, they're like the sci-fi dystopias that we see in popular culture on TV and film. But there are also within a lot of our publications and even, you know, industry journals and the like, a lot of the conversation around emerging technology in the future tends to focus on the downside risks. And that tends to stoke fear. And fear is a motivator, certainly. It's a powerful motivator, mm-hmm. but it's not one that's sustainable and it doesn't bring people together. And I think it's on all of us, both as educators and perhaps, if we want to say, as futurists or just as leaders, to actually help people see something of value and meaning to work toward. Mm-hmm. And then to actually help them to take some steps in that direction. And what do those steps look like? Well, I think the first thing that's a precondition there is trying to help foster a growth mindset within our partners, if you're in a classroom with your learners, if you're a parent with your children, or if you're a learner within yourself. And just by way of explanation quickly, for anyone who's not familiar, the idea of the growth mindset comes from the work of Carol Dweck, a psychologist at Stanford who wrote a book probably 12 or 14 years ago called Mindset, which is short. It's great reading. And the kind of cognitive shortcut here, the quick takeaway is she sets up a theory of mindset that juxtaposes the fixed mindset characterized by the belief that, you know, skills and abilities are more or less innate, that we are who we are, we can do what we can do because these are our talents, mm-hmm. Versus the growth mindset characterized by the ability that we can become who and what we want to be, that we can develop skills, that we can develop abilities. And, you know, anytime you hear somebody say, well, I'm just not good at math, or I'm too old to learn JavaScript, or this whole AI thing is far beyond my capability to comprehend. That's the fixed mindset. Mm-hmm. You hear somebody say, well, sometimes I can be this guy. I just don't dance. That's right. The fixed mindset too, frankly. Right. The growth mindset is the one who embraces the process and the challenge of learning. And learning means failing. And if you're not struggling, and there's lots of empirical research to support this in learning science, if you're not struggling, you're not learning. Mm-hmm. But we need to create conditions that are conducive to people developing that growth mindset. Because Dr. Dweck found, and many studies have repeated this, that the growth mindset is very highly correlated with successful outcomes in skill acquisition and in even a lot of what we would see as success in the career and in social environments over the long term.
Boy, I've kept you a long time here, Jeffrey, but I certainly appreciate your time. I do want to ask one more question before you go. What is the future need from CPAs? We've talked a lot about what CPAs need to do to get ready for the future. What does the future need from us?
So this could just be a beautiful synchronicity, but one of my favorite questions, and I talked about the importance of asking new and different questions, is exactly that, to kind of flip things on their head. And instead of what we often do, asking, what do I want? What do I need from the future? What do I need to be set up and to feel successful? What if instead we were to ask, what does the future need? And frame things that way. And this is a practice I picked up from a dear friend and colleague who right now is at the design school at Stanford named Lisa K. Solomon. And I think if the accountancy profession were to turn around and think about what does the future need, it's probably not just the narrow focus on regulatory compliance and the ability to successfully and reliably execute computational processes. Instead, I think it's going to be more in the role of the trusted advisor and more kind of in the vein of what we talked about earlier, helping people see new paths to prosperity in a shifting landscape amid considerable complexity, volatility, uncertainty, and ambiguity. And how can the CPA help to provide an increased certainty in an uncertain world? And I would argue that that's already what you're in the business of doing, but making sure to keep a more expansive sense of the purpose rather than a narrow focus on reproducing a result or a product or a single service is probably going to be more conducive to better imaginings of possible futures and better realizations of new value propositions, new relationships that go beyond the transactional and support long-term viability and best outcomes mutually and ecologically.
Well, Jeffrey Rogers, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for the time and for your insights. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with me today.
Bill, truly a pleasure. I've enjoyed it myself. Thanks for having me on, and have a great weekend.
That was Jeffrey Rogers, principal facilitator at Singularity University. He frequently connects dots and ideas for Fortune 500 companies and C-level audiences. And he does that as a moderator of executive education programs and large international summits. And you can find out more by visiting possiblefutures.design. And don't forget, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. We're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPAs. Start mastering these future ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. Don't forget those dashes. And I guess that's it. That's all I got, gang. That's all I've got for you. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again next week.